What's going on, everybody? My name is Satya Miele.
And I'm Brock Berenson.
And you're listening to So You're an Artist. It's the only podcast where we ask the all-too-important question, So You're an Artist.
What is your real job?
Oh, my God.
I'm running out of ways to say it.
Yeah, you probably are. But you can always go back to that weird voice you used to do.
What is your real job?
No, that... What is your real job? That one.
Oh.
What is your real job? When you were introducing that one guest one time, couldn't get me to stop fucking laughing.
Yeah.
We are a little bit more excitedly introducing the show today because we're finally in the same room again.
Yes.
We are in Brock's brand new, what do you call it? The tech room?
I call it the tech room.
It's the tech room.
It's like tech room / studio.
Yeah. How is ranch life treating you?
It's nice.
Yeah,
I like
it's quiet, right?
It's very quiet.
I mean, I've been up here one night and I'm very relaxed.
Yeah,
it feels nice.
Mm-hmm.
I slept so well last night. I told you already, but for our listeners, I slept fantastic up here last night. It's really quiet. It's dark. Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it gets like pitch black out here.
I don't know if I could live on a ranch permanently. I'm a total city guy. Like,
yeah, I mean, you can just visit. I mean, also, like, it's only an hour and a half, roughly, depending on traffic.
How long did it take us to get here? How long did it take us to get here, Cole? There's Cole in the room.
Like an hour and a half.
An hour and a half. Really?
About that.
Damn.
Roughly.
Yeah.
You also left at like height of traffic.
Dude. I know. That was unfortunate. I don't even know where we are. I know you've explained to me many times, like we're by Vasquez Rocks, but not like, whatever.
Technically, the town we're in isn't even a town or a village. It's a
what is it?
Like, designated like area. Like, I think it's like a council-y designated place, and that's...
Are people here considered citizens?
Yes, but, like, I don't understand, like, I've never heard of that as being a thing.
No, it's
like,
a
you're
thing.
Either a town or a village, and if you're any smaller than that, you're just a small village.
Sorry about, like, the sparseness of the podcast to the listeners. Life has been a little bit busy. It's been kind of crazy. So I'm gonna put this out on Monday, so I'll do this. I had the immense pleasure, and this is kind of a shameless plug, last Wednesday of being able to tape an episode of the Monday Morning Podcast live at the Troubadour Theater. And it was so much fun, and I think everybody should go and watch it so you can see my wonderful camera work. And that's going to be on YouTube, on the Bill Burr YouTube channel. So go ahead and check that out, folks. Please do. I'm sorry for making you have to sit through that, Brock. He looked out of the window wistfully, like, when is this guy going to shut the fuck up?
It's only because it's like... Because
I constantly talk about working with... Yeah, that's okay.
I mean, to be fair, though, you're working with a rather large comedian. One of the biggest comedians.
Yeah,
today.
It's cool. I so. Know. I you know, like it's. I try. Believe me, I try to stifle it.
Yeah,
I
understand
it a lot.
No, if it was me, I'd be like, yeah, I work with Bill Burr.
Yeah,
like every single conversation.
Work it into every conversation. It'd be fantastic.
Like, yeah, some comedians they don't do that. And you're like, which comedians? Bill Burr. He doesn't do that.
But anyway, yeah, so it's been kind of busy, but we're hoping over the winter break, which is, you know, coming soon, and Brock's already on it, we can, you know, bring you episodes once every 2 weeks, or we used to do it every week.
We could
back up to every week.
I feel like once every 2 weeks would give us a little too much leeway, and we'll get lazy.
You think?
Yeah.
We can bump it back up to once a week. We... had the immense pleasure of sitting down for a fourth time with Jose Castro. One more time. He's back on to close off our little six episode segment on representation and social justice as we've been talking about. And we're hoping that, you know, the ones that you've listened to in the past kind of help to like help you like also, you know, kind of start paying attention to these conversations and start involving yourself and stuff like that. That makes this sound like it's not a savior thing, you guys. It's just like our version of it's just how we wanted to contribute, and that's just kind of how we thought we could. And we talk about it in this episode. I specifically mentioned I'm not a big social media guy, so I'm not constantly like posting much of stuff. And you know, I was a protester for a little while, and we talked about with Jose about how your activism can change, it can morph. And as long as you're you can pivot, and as long as you're paying attention and you're activated. He kept saying the word activated, which is I like that word. So anyway, we chatted with Jose about that, and he also introduced us to a new project he's working on, which we would very much like to share with you guys.
Yes.
So Jose has started a new virtual program via Zoom. It is called Life Master, the Practice of Adaptive Satisfaction. Join Now House Education Group founder Jose Angel Castro for an introductory session to a compelling and timely 6-week wellness workshop on adaptive satisfaction, a perspective shift that will teach you to harness the power of the pivot in an ever-changing world. Jose will guide you to a sense of agency over the trajectory of your life in these dynamic and uncertain times. If you would like to register for the introductory program, go ahead and check out the description of our podcast, where we will include both Eventbrite links for November 28th and December 5th. That's November 28th and December 5th. Mark it down in your calendar, folks. I really hope you guys have enjoyed these last 5 episodes on, you know, on representation and justice and injustice and what you can do to, you know, expand your circle and whatnot. I think we've definitely learned a lot. I hope you've learned a lot.
I know I have.
The guests have been absolutely fantastic. And, well, enjoy the 6th one.
Yeah.
Anything else, Brock?
They've already enjoyed it. You said enjoy the 6th one.
Yeah, this is the 6th. They're about to enjoy the 6th one. We're still doing the introduction here.
Oh, I thought this was the outro.
No, it's not the outro.
Enjoy the 6th one, people.
I like your background. Is that like a... Is that something you painted, or is that just...
It's a photograph I took. It's the Blue Grotto in Italy, on the island of Capri.
Wow. It's beautiful.
Yeah, go there.
Is it like one of those kind of tiered cliff towns sort of thing, you know, side of the water?
Mountain. The port is right on the surface of the sea there, and then everything else you have to go, you pretty much have to go up to get to.
Kind of like Ilios in Greece.
Yeah. There's another island. I would recommend these two islands that you definitely should visit if you get the opportunity, especially if you can get Italian citizenship, which I hear that one party in this Zoom can, in fact, do. Ischia, which is an island that is mainly visited by Italians. And the island of Capri. Two very different experiences, but two absolutely lovely experiences. The Blue Grotto, you rent a boat, you hire a boat from the port there, and they take you to this cave. And this is what it looks like. And the illumination of the water is just the sunlight that pours in from the one opening in the cave. It's really
That's
gorgeous.
Crazy.
It looks insane. Absolutely amazing. I fantasize about going to those seaside Italian towns at least once a week. And I do have my Italian citizenship, so as soon as travel restrictions lift,
I'm
out of here.
And you're young and you got no responsibilities. You need to get the fuck out of here.
I really do.
You really do. There's only two things in my estimation that are worth spending your money on. One is food.
Yes.
And the other is travel. The rest of it, I don't care about the car I drive. I don't care about living in a fancy house. I want to go places and meet people and eat good food.
I'm totally with you on that.
I mean, I do spend money on gadgets, but you know, that's nothing compared to the amount of money I'm willing to spend on food and travel.
That would always be really interesting to see back at Star when you would walk in with some. I would be like, "What is that?" And you would construct something out of like sticks and stones, and it would be a projector. And it would be like, "Okay, he's got a small 4K projector on him."
in a false book in a backpack. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm all into that stuff.
Brock, is there anything you and Jose have not talked in a while? Yeah. Is there anything would you like to, before we jump into our main topic here?
It's good to see you, man.
Yeah, it's good to see you too.
Yeah, brother.
Yeah. I can't.
Like I said, really, Brock sobbed uncontrollably when he heard you were coming back.
Oh, for sure.
That's insane.
One of my favorite guests right here. So,
thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, I appreciate it. I love coming and talking to you guys. I will always, if you invite me, I'll come because I love talking to you guys.
Awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I guess the only thing that I really have to contribute to this conversation, just as like a starting point, is have you read, I believe it's Alice Walker's Everyday Use?
I have not.
It's a very good read. It's very short, too.
I have to write it down. I'm going to write it down right now.
What?
Alice Walker, Everyday Use.
Everyday Use, yeah.
What is it about it that you like so much?
It's a short story about an African-American family where it's just a mom and her two daughters, and they live in rural America, and one daughter is like fancy queen of Siam, and one daughter is like a total homebody. And it's, I believe it takes place in either the 60s or early 70s. So it's about everyday use of old items from the mm-hmm. heirlooms of their family.
Right.
And yeah, I think it's just a really fun, good read.
Oh, I have to check that out.
Yeah.
I'm excited. I'll read it. I'll see if I can find it tonight. Mm-hmm.
Here we are in the in our final yet just beginning episode of our little 6-part, you know, series on representation and social justice and everything. I can't tell if you guys are frozen or just not moving at all.
I'm just listening.
Yeah, just not moving. Okay.
I hate Zoom so much. I wish we were in person. For our listeners, the reason that I call this the end and the beginning is because these last 6 episodes are supposed to be a jumping off point with several different perspectives for people to be able to continue having the conversations that you know, we've been having, and also for us, for me and Brock, to try to incorporate this kind of stuff, especially when we're talking about the arts,
right?
Which I think is really important.
Yeah, no, there's a lot to unpack, man. There's a lot to unpack.
There is. We are now in mid to late-ish November. We're like in the
right in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah, right in the middle of November. It's been several months since the large push for social justice in the U.S. specifically, beginning with Black Lives Matter this summer, which, as we've said so many times, how it had to take a pandemic to, you know, get people to pay attention. And I'm 100% guilty of that as well. But so I don't know. I guess I wanted to ask you, like, you know, from your perspective, and also you, Brock, this is for all three of us, like, where are we?
That's a really good question.
I know it's really broad and really loaded.
Currently,
but
we are in the Milky Way galaxy.
okay. Yeah.
On the third rock from the sun. Before I try to give you an answer on that, I have a question for you that may put you on the spot a little bit.
Go ahead.
How many black people have you spoken to?
In general or since then?
On the show.
On the show?
About this subject.
About this subject specifically, it was you and Joshua Silverstein.
Right on.
And the thing is, the other episodes were not specifically about Black Lives Matter because we covered also Latinx theater and...
Which you could also do with me.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's right, too. I should introduce you to...
Oh, you see? You see? You see? You see? You missed details. It's interesting.
I know. No, I totally...
I'm putting you on your spot, and I'm watching you blush over there.
Well, I know you're... partially Hondureño, is that the right?
Not partially.
Fully.
100%. 100%. It's interesting because I was talking to a friend of mine about that the other day, and we were specifically talking about the way the way American culture has driven a wedge between black people, black Americans, and Latinx people.
Yeah.
And how much that didn't make sense, and how people like me actually represent a bridge between those two cultures. Mm-hmm. People who are Afro-Latino, who are what I affectionately term as Choco-Latino, who either immigrated to this country or who grew up in this country,
right,
really do represent people who live squarely within both of those cultures. Because when people talk to me, or before people talk to me, they don't know anything about my family culture. They don't know anything about the fact that Spanish is my first language.
Right.
So from that outside perspective, I'm strictly African American. And if we look at it more broadly, African American should actually include people from North America all the way through South America,
mm-hmm.
because the transatlantic slave trade yeah. was responsible for bringing black people into this part of the world. And the biggest black population outside of Africa actually lives in Brazil.
Yeah.
So when you say African American, you're actually broadly talking about a whole bunch more people than just black people in North America.
Yeah, that was something specifically we talked about in one of my classes last year, you know, specifically regarding the transatlantic slave trade, because, I mean, they showed us one of those animated maps, and the concentration of ships going to Brazil was actually much higher than going to the U.S.
Yes, yes, because of the Amazonian resources.
And we definitely discussed, you know, yeah, the, you know, the disconnect, and also the bridge, and yeah, the fact that it's covering so much more than people think.
So much space. And actually the greatest horrors of the transatlantic slave trade, most people don't know that it actually happened in the Caribbean. And a lot of the people who were stolen and brought to the Caribbean didn't survive.
Yeah.
Right. Which is why rebellions were so much more common in the Caribbean,
right?
Because you didn't have the passing on of generational trauma, right? So those people were much harder to control, because the sort of iterations before them basically just died off and were replaced.
Yeah.
Which gave rise to the Haitian Revolution, you know, blah blah blah. But no, it's interesting. It's interesting. I think the thing that, to answer what you were saying before, I think the thing that becomes one aspect of all this that becomes abundantly clear, is that in America, our perspective on what it is to be black in America is incredibly narrow, when contrasted with the reality, right? No matter where the perspective comes from. And I think also that can be said to be true within the black community itself. And when you start shedding light on everything the way that the convergence of these global crises have done, you really shed light on that fact, on the fact that people just don't know how incredibly diverse the black community in America is within the black community.
Yeah.
Because most of the time we see what's presented to us. We only see the athlete, or we see the drug dealer, or we see the rapper, or, you know what I mean? We don't really see the nuances of the community, like, you know, the dad who's raising three daughters on his own, you know, who's, you know, breaking his neck working as a mechanic, and, you know, whatever, which actually is the plot to a film, but still, you know, those nuances are kind of lost. And I think now what we're starting to see is we're starting to see a broader view. I think also we start to see a broader view based on what other people are disenfranchised as connected to the black community. You understand what I mean? So Black Lives Matter shed light on the fact that Latinx lives matter, shed light on the fact that trans lives matter, shed light on, and I'm not saying other things resulted necessarily from that sort of, I'm saying this for the first time, from that sort of enlightenment. But they're definitely tied. They're correlated, right? Because you saw things like Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd happen in a very short period of time, and Christian Cooper, the guy in the park that the lady called the police on.
Yeah.
Because you saw all of those things happen in such a concentrated amount of time, it's kind of unfathomable to understand that that sparked a global movement toward looking at people who are disenfranchised. Looking at people who are misunderstood, looking at people who I think one of the things that should include that I don't hear a lot about, that I haven't heard addressed very much in a sincere way, is when you're talking about economic disparities, which includes our white brothers and sisters who were born into generational poverty, right? Those people, and I probably won't be very popular for saying so, but those people don't feel privileged. And I think that's why we might be in the boat we are in when it comes to people swinging so far right politically,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right?
Because the poor people who swing that far right, forgive me for saying, but you know, the Trumps of the world wouldn't piss on those people if they were on fire, right?
Right.
But they feel really marginalized because people aren't paying attention to them being poor and having real issues. You know, their schools are just as shitty as schools in the hood. There are nuanced differences, mind you. I don't want to diminish any of that. But, you know, if you're a white person living in a trailer park, out in the desert, and you don't know where your next meal is coming from, you don't feel white privilege. If you didn't finish high school, and your mom didn't finish high school, and her mom didn't finish high school, you still carry that generational trauma of poverty, right? And we just don't talk about that enough, I don't think. And those are the key points that unite everybody, right? Because Black people in this country didn't get this way on our own, right? And there are other people who have been placed in the same boxes, only all of the boxes have been separated. And I think that's where the fear from the power structure comes from. Because if you begin to allow people, or if people begin to understand the similarities between each other, they will find that there are far more similarities than there are differences. And that being the case, then you start getting people, the people who are disenfranchised, you start getting them unifying. And that's a scary prospect for the people who are in power.
It's what we need.
It's what should happen.
Yeah.
It's what should happen. It's what we idealize as happening. And I think periods like where we are opportunities for that. Right? But if I were to very simply answer the question of where we are, it would be, we are where we don't know.
Yeah.
The space we're in is, if we're standing on a tight wire and we fall right, we fall into utopia. If we fall left, we fall into hell. And that's right where we are. And the scary part of it for most people, for everybody, we share this sort of collective dread because we don't know. Because whatever comes next, all we know is that it's different. But we don't know what it's going to be. So that is that's where I think we are.
Do you feel that maybe that little bit of like collective fear that, especially since, you know, now we're having, you know, the new guy in the White House and everything, that maybe there's going to be some... Yeah, maybe. Don't frighten me like
that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that. Go ahead.
I understand that, of course, another Trump term would do much less to me than it would to, you know, other people. But it's still just like No.
Yeah.
But still, do you feel a little bit of that collective fear that there's going, that, you know, now that, you know, Biden's hopefully going to, you know, be in the White House, that there's going to be some sort of apathy now coming along with it? Just some people are be like, well, we did it. It's over. Because I kind of see that happening a little bit. Like, people are, I understand the celebration and everything. And I have, there's literally no one in the center, especially in the social media accounts I follow. It's either people who are like, oh, great, now we're going to, like, who immediately start jumping on everything that he needs to change, that he needs to do. And they jump in right off the bat, letters, petitions, everything. Immediately start catching him on every wrong step he's making. And then there's other people who are abundantly just celebrating as if the world is saved.
Right.
So, I mean, do you fear that there will be that, you know, something will fall apart, or I don't know. Like, I know we're literally at, we don't know, but if you had to make a, you know, I don't know. Are you optimistic is my question. Instead of do you fear, are you optimistic?
Well, it's an interesting thing because I get kind of split down the middle, because at the same time, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic for the opportunities. I'm pessimistic because of human behavior.
Yeah.
It's basically what it comes down to.
No, I understand that.
And the human behavior part that comes in what you're talking about is people are always looking for a magic pill. Always. It's because magic pills remove responsibility.
Yeah.
So if Biden and Harris are a magic pill, then I don't have to worry about next time around when it comes to, you know, voting for the people in my city or the people in my county or the people in my state. I don't have to be as diligent and as vigilant next time around because, well, things are normal again. Right? But this concept of back to normal to me is ridiculous, because there is no back. At this point, there is no back, because democracy as we've known it is changed.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many elements of democracy that have changed, and we can't go back. That's the whole thing about this Make America Great Again thing. You know, when you take it down to a practical level, the ideals of Make America Great Again, those ideals are in the past, and I don't care who wants to argue with me about it, you're not going back to that. Because back to that means either ignoring and or subjugating the fastest growing parts of the population of the United States of America, which simply isn't going to happen, right? So, I don't know. I mean, I'm optimistic because the people chose something else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pessimistic because the other people didn't. In the wake of the destruction of democracy as we know it, I'm optimistic in that, you know, we spend time inside thinking about things, contemplating our collective contribution, contemplating our individual contribution. But you have people running around in the streets like there's nothing going on with a virus that is so smart, right? You have people ignoring major stuff right now.
Mm-hmm.
That affects everybody, you know? So I always lean toward optimism, I guess, because I always lean toward adaptation, because I always lean toward inevitably everything's going to change anyway. I also lean toward optimism because of your generation and the generations that follow you. Because I think if we get to the point where you guys can smoothly take over, then the world will be a different place, right? For all of the hangups of your generation and the generations after you, for all of the technological nonsense that we deal with on a regular basis, for all the things that we lament having lost as generations in terms of social life and all that stuff, your generations are really savvy, really smart. really empathetic, right? We talked about this before, Satya, yeah. that for your generation, the word is acceptance. For our generation, the word is tolerance. There's a huge difference, right? So when it comes time for your grandchildren to be born, your grandchildren will be thinking completely different than three generations behind them.
Yeah.
Right? So that's where I find my solace and my optimism is in those thoughts. And my contributions to the world are aimed at that. Right? My contributions to my little world or the people I have influence with, that's what I'm trying to get to. I'm trying to get to people shifting the way that they think about things, the perspective that they have about things.
Once a teacher, always a teacher.
More toward the whole system is healthier if we pay attention to the whole system.
Yeah. What do you see after acceptance? Is there anything after acceptance?
I actually think acceptance is kind of the ultimate, because it allows things that have been such barriers between people to simply not be a thing. Right. For instance, non-binary world. You know, I think if you're still thinking about the world in terms of being binary, you're like really late to the game. Right. But when we start to think about that just that one segment of society, just that one LGBTQ+ segment of society, and the fact that for your generations, and especially for the generation coming right after you, it's simply not a thing. It's not that there's judgment either way. It's not that it just isn't a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And kids will completely defend their friends, the people that they know who are within the LGBTQ+ communities, to their non-binary prejudiced parents or grandparents, because for them it's not a thing and they're willing to defend it to the hilt.
Yeah. So I mean, so with acceptance, it seems like there comes, you know, it's not very hippy dippy of me, but unconditional love is what comes with acceptance as well. Just
I absolutely believe that is true. It's the idea that, and also very hippy dippy concept, is you be you and I'll be me and everything's cool. Right? I think with acceptance also comes sort of self-reliance and self-confidence, because I don't need to judge you. I'm good. Right? Because I'm not only accepting of somebody else, I'm accepting of myself.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about whether or not I'm gay or cis or lesbian or whatever. It just doesn't matter. It's a non-issue, you know? And I think that there are a lot of things, and it's the truth. It's the same truth about race. It's the same truth about culture. You know, acceptance means it doesn't matter because it shouldn't matter. Right. And that's a huge plus for the generations that are following.
Yeah.
You know, and the older generations that are still holding, and this is also not a very popular statement, but the older generations that are still holding to all that bullshit, they're going to be dead soon.
Yeah.
It's just the truth of it.
Yeah.
Right? And they can scream about things being the same and holding on to the old days as much as they want. But that will not stop the inevitability of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's it. That's all of it. So if I see that generationally, and I see that across cultures too, because I travel a lot. So yeah. Like, you know, I meet a lot of people and talk to their kids, and I see a kind of universality to that whole thing. Right. And I actually think it's because of the internet.
Right.
You know,
we talked about this. Yeah.
Yeah. Prejudice breeds in isolation. And I think it's much harder to isolate your kids now. mm-hmm. much, much harder. And especially now during COVID when everybody's Zooming and everybody's, you know, spending a lot of time online, it's even harder because you're talking to and growing friendships and nurturing relationships with people who don't look like you, who don't live like you, who don't have the same culture as you. And that goes exactly counter to any messages that people might be giving you that you should hate that kind of person or not trust that kind of person or whatever. I think it's just harder. And that's a fact that I don't think a lot of people have woken up to yet.
If I may actually sidetrack really quick, I have a really quick question for you as a teacher and sort of a multifaceted, you know, I'm trying to think of a other word other than influencer, because that's become such a toxic term.
That's me making vomiting sounds, pre-vomiting sounds. I just threw up in my mouth a little bit.
Let's say a teacher, universal term here, teacher. As a teacher, how has Zoom, you know, moving online to this platform, how has that affected your, you know, kind of your, and mission sounds too dramatic, but like, you know, your push for doing what you want to do?
It's a very interesting question because actually, I'll give you the most recent example. I launched a workshop since the pandemic started. I've been looking really diligently searching for my way of contributing to people getting through this a little bit better.
Yeah.
Right. Also for selfish reasons, because that helps me get through this a little bit better. Right. But if I can apply my skills in ways that let people live a little bit better, a little bit easier through this and after this, then I feel like I've done something good. Right. So my contribution right now, my main contribution is a workshop that I call Life Master.
I'll come to the next one, I promise.
You suck. no, there's actually going to be, I'm not shamelessly plugging, but there's going to be another intro class. There's two more, actually, one on November 28th and one on December 5th. Brock, please, if you can make it, please come.
Totally.
I'll send you all the requisite information.
Yeah, awesome. No, we'll thank plug you it at the beginning for sure.
And it's nice because it starts at 9:30 in the morning, so it doesn't get in the way of your Saturday.
Right,
it's done
right.
by 11, right? But the subtitle is The Practice of Adaptive Satisfaction. And Satya, you know me as a teacher in the classroom. For the listeners, I'm super dynamic. You may not be able to hear that just in my voice, but I move around a lot. I gesture a lot. Sometimes I dance. Sometimes I stand on chairs and tables and whatnot. whatever it takes to capture and hold the attention of the people who are this. It's kind of a show for me. So who are in my audience, the students, whoever, attendees, whatever. So I started this workshop and it launched with the first introductory lesson last Saturday. And leading up to that class, the intention was, okay, how do I create the same kind of atmosphere in Zoom that I would if I were standing in the middle of these people sitting in a circle?
Right.
Right. So how do I adapt to the medium? It's just like when I'm taking photographs, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm making photographs, I think anybody who's a good shooter can shoot with anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's never the gear. It's always the shooter, right? So if I can take a good picture with the latest, greatest Nikon Super Z, whatever, I should be able to take a good picture with a cell phone or with a disposable phone or with a Holga or whatever. Right. So that's what I haven't had in mind when I decided to do this class. So I built the entire story, including visuals and technical stuff and music and all that, based on that intention. And what it really excites me is that the impact on the attendees was what I needed it to be.
Right.
And that impact was that the people coming out of that class said to me the things that I intended to give them on my way in, right? That the class was clear, that the message was clear, that it was useful, that it was practical, that it was smooth, that they enjoyed being there, that it was a lovely atmosphere. All of those things I would want if we were standing in a room together. So to answer your question as well, it's me. It's what I do to make that room, virtual or otherwise, what needs to happen for people to get the information I'm trying to convey. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And that particular course is really fascinating to me because it really is about what happens on the other end of all these crises, on how we make our way into the rest of our lives, which are going to be different than now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's timely because we're sitting around at our houses, you know, most of us feeling every emotion that's possible to feel over the course of a day.
Yeah.
And we have the opportunity for introspection.
Right.
So if ever you're going to do this kind of work, now would be the time.
Yeah.
I think I want to ask you, because something we've asked every guest in this little segment we're doing is, how do you avoid activism burnout? But I think what I want to ask you is, oh, did we freeze?
No.
Oh, God, nope. You guys are just like statues.
Just listening.
Statue.
How do we avoid desensitization?
How do we avoid desensitization? I think we avoid desensitization by constantly being in the practice of paying attention.
I see.
And having a constant sense of intention when it comes to what we're actually going to, excuse my French, but what we're actually going to fucking do in this moment. Because activism without action is empty, right? And the other part of that, key part of that is caring for yourself, is knowing your limits, right? You got to know your limits.
Yeah.
For instance, I haven't been to a single protest because I understand my limits. My role in being activated with all of this stuff, with everything that we're going through right now, and I have my little fingers and toes in trying to contribute to all segments of these crises that are happening, right? But I know my role this time around is not in the streets. When the women's marches came around after the last election, I was at every single one that I could go to.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that this time around, I can't go out into the streets. So that's part of me taking care of myself and also taking care of other people on the streets figuring out how else I can do my part, right? So if on any given day, you know, you're like, if you're a protester, if that's what you want to do, if that's what you need to do, you need to go out in the streets and express yourself in that way, and you go to 5 protests, and then the 6th protest comes, and every fiber of your being tells you, don't go to the protest, and you go anyway, and that's the protest that breaks your mind and breaks your cycle of intention and activism, then you've done yourself a disservice.
I see.
Right? So without actually taking care of oneself and without awareness of where you are, you can't do that. You know? So you burn out because you don't rest.
I understand. Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I guess me personally, I'm still even sort of finding my footing, because at first I was a protester. I would go out there with friends and we would go there, we'd protest, we'd have our cameras too, because we'd document, you know, we'd be like,
right,
you know, we want to kind of capture what's happening through our own lens at the same time as being there to support. After a while, I was never a big social media activist kind of person. What I did do for a while, for several months, and I'm still sort of doing it, is refusing to post like nothing's wrong, like nothing's right. happening. I think right. like when I started seeing people put up selfies again, beach selfies, and a bunch of, you know, hey, check this thing out. I don't know. I was a little part of me was like, it just seems. It's just like, do you not realize, you know, what's happening? I guess, you know.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
So I don't know. But at the same time, that's part of like, I don't want to be one to judge how people, you know, express themselves with.
I like didn't post about like Blackout Tuesday or anything and felt extremely guilty for not doing so.
Mm-hmm.
However, I was going through my own shit at the time. I didn't even realize it was happening until after it happened.
Right.
And I was like, well, now I can't do anything about it. When in actuality, I could have posted like the following Tuesday or something. But yeah, that's sort of just something that I experienced.
You know, I think always, there always is room to some for, you know, for someone to do something. And the thing is, especially, look, if you're not an activist at heart, if you are not someone who intrinsically just has to get out on the streets and constantly be expressing yourself about this kind of stuff, but you genuinely want to help, it can be difficult to kind of be like, well, okay, how can I help?
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that was something that, you know, I was, you know, searching for myself. And that's the thing, you know, there's people throw so many different ways that you can help, but you can get easily overwhelmed.
Yeah, such a for sure.
Fucking privileged position to come from anyway. You know what I mean?
Right.
Just pick one and well, be there, you know, show up.
And what's going to be my next point is what's available is you're free to pivot. If you're going to protests and you run into a wall and you don't want to go to protests anymore, there's plenty of other ways to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there are no rules in terms of, oh, you can only contribute this way or there's a protest tonight and you're a protester, so you have to go to the protest. No, maybe there's something else you can do. Maybe you can, you know, buy some water and give it to somebody who's going to the protest for protesters to use. Maybe you can volunteer doing something else somewhere else for a different purpose within. I mean, there's enough crisis to go around.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean?
So dumb,
there are enough things. There are enough things to be activated about, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be activated about all of it. We just can't be activated all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, you know, if you missed that Blackout Tuesday, guess what? There was something else another week after that.
Yeah.
You know, or if you're really into it, create your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's also that. There's also those possibilities. So there's plenty of stuff to go around. For sure. He's frozen again.
Oh, he's gone.
Mm-hmm. Good thing you're recording.
Yeah, for sure. Right. Yeah, he always makes me record these things because his internet is just god awful.
Yeah, yeah.
I do want to do like some art to help support like the Black Lives Matter movement.
Right.
I just don't know exactly where I would be posting that and stuff. Oh, he's full gone. Wow.
Yeah, he's like he just signed off.
Wow. But I don't know like where I would be posting that or whatever.
Right. Yeah, no. I mean, I think the thing to do, Brock, mm-hmm. is to make it.
Yeah.
Whatever it is that you're thinking, make it, express it, and where it will go will follow.
Right.
Right? But if you're constantly ruminating over where you're going to put it,
mm-hmm.
it might never get made.
That's completely true.
You know, so make it. Make it and put it on your Instagram and see what happens.
Right.
See if something else comes of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Something that I learned is that it's okay to ask, because there was a lot of stuff, and, you know, social media being our main outlet to the world, that's how you find this stuff out. So, you know, when I'd be looking online, and we talked a lot about this, the condemnation of allyship, there's a lot of just like, you know, if you have to ask, you're the problem kind of thing. Like, if you don't
right,
know how
right.
And that, and look, there's a very, especially, you know, me looking the way I do and being from the community I am, there is something where you go like, well, then I don't want to help at all. You don't want my help. Fine. There's that. And there's, you know, I think the biggest push for a lot of people was to put that aside and be like, you need to understand the anger and the passion, and you need to understand the hundreds of years of suffering that are behind this. And now that, you know, that it's actually being given attention. You need, like, there's a whole, there was an understanding that a lot of people were kind of resisting at first. And now for me, it feels like there's a lot more openness to it. Like we talked about acceptance. So yeah, that's what I learned, is that it's okay to ask too. You know, you don't have to, now that doesn't mean, you know, find your one black friend and ask them to educate you on.
Well, and also things, doesn't mean that it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody will be open.
Mm-hmm. That too.
To what you've asked of them. But I think what people need to pay attention to is the fact that we're all uncomfortable. Right? You know, on one side, people are asking if they can help, and you've been without help for so long that you reject their help. You're like, mm-hmm. No, you can't help. And then on the other side, I ask you if I can help and I get rejected. So I get butt hurt. And then I decide I'm going to throw my hands up and I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Either way, nothing gets done. Right. So everybody has some shit that they have to work out. Right. The Black American community has never seen this level of allyship in its history, in its entire history.
Right.
Right. So it's going to take some getting used to. Our white brothers and sisters who want to help maybe have never made such an effort before. And many people don't understand that sometimes it's easier to throw your hands up and be butt hurt than to stick to it and actually make the changes happen that you say you want to make happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because this whole thing is a long game. This is not a short game. So, and remember, we talked about that last time, is the people who are true allies, they're going to stick around. They're going to stick around whether somebody's pissed at them, whether they got their feelings hurt, whether they're embraced or not. The people who are there out of convenience, especially in the whole influencer, social media world, those are the people who started a couple weeks later posting bikini selfies again.
Yeah.
And the truth is, I don't care about that part.
Yeah.
That part's not serving the overarching goal, so it doesn't count. Right? If somebody is performative, go ahead and be performative, because I know that you're not going to be here for very long. You know? But you know, with your 300,000 followers, maybe you'll reach 10,000 people who actually care and who will actually do something and who will actually be activated and stick to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And when it's time for you to fall away, I'm indifferent to you.
So how about when, cause they're like, I don't know if I mentioned this, there are these sort of natural born activist people who are, that's what they want to devote their life to, service. That's what they, you know, mm-hmm. want to do, at least for a certain part of their life. My mom was like that. She, you know, when she went to India, all she did was just service, just trying to, you know, worked with all the volunteer services, everything.
Right.
And I suppose there are, I don't know, where is that line between just like where, you know, you want, like, you know, because there's, I feel like there's activism as an identity, and then there's activism as something that you want to participate in because you want to help out of, you know, because you genuinely want to help. But at the same time, like, it's not, it doesn't engulf you. It's not entirely who you are. So I don't know, like, where, if you,
well, it's about being activated.
Right.
So if you're activated behind a specific something, okay, you do your part, you put your thing in, and then you're out. I mean, everybody's not going to be Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Cesar Chavez,
mm-hmm.
right? People are going to make their contribution. It's whether or not people decide and intend to make their contribution actively consistently, and sincerely.
Right.
Right. You know, everybody's not going to be, you know, standing on vans and pumping their fists in the air their entire lives. Most people aren't. But if you're a person who takes it upon yourself and has the empathy to contribute in that way, great. It's the judgment part that I think is the problem.
That's what it is. There's such a fear of judgment.
Both from the individual level, both me fearing what other people are going to think or want or whatever, and other people from the outside judging what other people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Just let people be what they're going to be, man. Just let people do what they're going to do. You know,
this is such a hippy dippy episode for sure. We might as well be passing a joint around and just like.
No, but it's the truth. I mean, you know, you boil it down to like, you know, you boil it down and either you do or you don't. Either you stay or you go. Either you act or you sit back. There aren't any in-betweens there. You know, if you got something to say about all of the stuff that's going on right now, say it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody necessarily expects you to say it for the rest of your life. You know, a big thing that I've been saying recently is, you know, we spend too much time on either or and not enough time on and.
Right.
It's this and that. It's not necessarily this or that. Right. It's the fact that the Black community has had certain stuff to deal with, and the point that I made earlier, and the poor white community has had stuff to deal with. Right? It's not either or. You get what I'm saying.
Yeah, of course. Oh wow, that flew by. So really, thank you for stopping by again. And I know we didn't, in the last one we discussed more of the arts and stuff like that, but I kind of wanted to sort of focus on this one just a little bit more, just the conversation itself, and then we'll you know. But hey, you know, your next big project, whatever you got, you come back on, talk about it.
Yeah. No, the workshop that I'm doing is my next big project.
Right.
And to me, it looks and feels just like creating anything else.
Right.
It's like the same as if I'm creating a dress or I'm writing a play or whatever. You know, the night before I couldn't sleep. Right before I clicked onto the Zoom, I felt those same butterflies in my stomach.
Yeah.
That I've felt when I'm standing backstage and the orchestra begins to play. That same rush is the same rush that I felt right before going into the Zoom circle. So it's, you know, it's the same stuff.
It's amazing. And
it is creation for me.
It's amazing, you know? To me because I haven't felt that in a while. So that's just, it makes me incredibly happy for you as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Once again, thank you so much. And as per usual, you're always welcome back. This was really nice. This was, I know the energy here was a little bit more kind of like easy and sort of direct and everything. But
no, I dug it, man. I dug it. It is what it is.
Well, yeah. Thanks for
hippy dippy to still be hippy dippy about it.
I think we always learn a lot whenever you stop by. So
for sure.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was really good to see you guys.
Yeah, it's really good to see you too, man.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I very much hope you enjoyed the interview as much as we did.
Yeah.
All right. As per usual, never miss an episode of So You're an Artist by subscribing to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brock, where can they keep up with us for behind-the-scenes updates and drawing challenges?
Yes. On Instagram, you have @artist.pod, and on Twitter, @artist_pod. And you can also write us a lovely email at syaapod@gmail.com. Also, don't forget to leave us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot.
If it's not 5 stars, we'll just sweep it under the rug, yeah. As we say.
Pull a Putin. Just completely erase it from existence.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode of So You're an Artist. I have been Sati Miele.
And I have been Brock Berenson.
And we will see you again very soon.
We'll see you soon.
Okay.
We will have seen you in the next episode.
Yeah.
fuck. Okay.